at the table wished they could do.
"Miss Spencer, I only meant his rations will be docked," he said quietly. "Don't trouble yourself. He must learn discipline, but it was hardly a capital offense."
There was a softness to the words that she hadn't expected. "Were you ever disciplined?" He nodded, rubbing a thumb over his bottom lip. Etta watched its path as it skimmed over the generous curve until she remembered she wasn't supposed to be watching at all. Focus. Home. The pearl was cool between her fingers as she rolled her left earring back and forth. For a moment she felt a strange prickling sensation just below it, like someone was watching the stretch of skin where her exposed neck met her shoulder. But when she looked up again, there was no one else nearby, and Nicholas had fixed his eyes on the moon.
"When I was about his age, certainly," he said. "I had a devil of a temper then, and it took every ounce of Hall's restraint to keep from smothering me out of exasperation. I thanked him for it in the end, since he gave me the opportunity to be part of his crew. I prefer the candor of this life, that we're forced to cut out things that don't truly matter, qualities that matter far more to landlubbers. Here, what defines me first and foremost is my work, my capabilities, just the same as Jack. And unless you've been pressed into a Navy ship, a man's here by choice."
Nicholas didn't come right out and say it, but she had a feeling these qualities directly related to the color of his skin.
"You really didn't wish to leave Nassau," he said quietly,
apparently coming to some conclusion of his own. "No, I didn't." The understatement of this particular century. Etta blew out a sigh, pulling the length of her braid over her shoulder. The wind had picked up, as promised, and was whipping the loose strands around in a flurry.
"I'm sure the unfortunate travel companion doesn't help matters."
"Companion," she said with a dry laugh. He was avoiding her name. Nicholas closed his eyes for a beat, and when they opened he'd clearly made a decision.
"Sophia Ironwood would gladly cut the limbs from my body, pickle them and throw them in a trough for the pigs. She would rather perish than admit we come from the same stock, let alone that we have anything in common beyond a mutual distaste for each other."
The words caught her across the face like a spray of seawater, a cold slap of realization. We come from the same stock. Family. As in... She stepped back, studying his profile, and he refused to meet her gaze. Of course. Of course. Why hadn't she seen that possibility before? I have seen the rotten edges of his soul. I know him for the deceitful swine he is. Would Sophia have said something so virulent about someone she barely knew? And he'd mentioned Ironwood, Sophia's grandfather, any number of times, with more knowledge behind the word than a casual business acquaintance. Sophia knew him because he was one of them. A traveler. But he was here, taking each shift in the wind and water as if he'd been born on a ship. If he'd been sailing since he was a child, then when? Etta took another full step back away from him. Stunned.
"She truly told you nothing," Nicholas said, his voice flat. "I cannot say I'm surprised."
"You..." Etta struggled to bring her fractured thoughts back in line. "You weren't going to tell me either, were you? Do you have any idea what I've been through? How much better I would have felt at that dinner table, knowing I had a real ally? God, no wonder you kept stepping in when I messed up. You had to."
"Of course I stepped in to assist you," Nicholas said, seeming almost confused. "It is against our laws, and against better judgment, to allow our secret to be revealed. You should know this well by now."
And just like that, she knew that her plan would never work. Even if she could win the rest of the crew over, they wouldn't go against his wishes. She wasn't going to be able to grind his resistance down with reason or charm. Not that she was all that certain she even had anything resembling charm. Nicholas wasn't just a hired acquaintance orbiting around the periphery of the Ironwood family's galaxy. He was part of their system. He was one of them.
"Your training," he began.
"What training?" she cried, letting her temper fly again. "I didn't even know I could time travel until Sophia pushed me through a passage or whatever you call it."
"Pushed you?"
He spun back toward her, eyes flashing.
You mean to tell me you've never traveled before now? Try never traveled, never heard the name Ironwood, and possibly never going back to my home. They aren't even my family. They killed someone I love to get to me. He swore viciously under his breath, turning his back on her for a moment. You didn't even know you possessed the ability. Your traveler sickness must have been unbearable. No wonder no one on the crew saw you. You must have been unconscious for days.
Traveler's sickness?
No, she couldn't get distracted, not about this. Don't act like you weren't in on this, Etta said. You and Sophia, no, he said sharply, drawing her toward him, walking them both backward. She realized, as the world suddenly took shape around her again, that Wren and Chase had left the cabin, and were now moving steadily toward the hatch to the lower deck.
Don't put me in league with her. Ironwood's request said nothing of this. I assumed he was calling you and Sophia back to assign you some task. I don't make a habit of abductions, Miss Spencer.
You mean aside from stealing other people's ships and holding their crews hostage? His brows rose, and he actually looked like he might smile. That settled her, but only somewhat.
His letter didn't explain anything else? She asked. Nothing about why he wants to see me?
No. I was to intercept the Ardent and bring you and Sophia to New York by September 21st.
Christ, he muttered, rubbing the back of his neck.
The first time I traveled, I attacked an automobile with an umbrella and nearly pissed myself in terror. So when I say you are taking this well, I hope you'll believe me.
Etta couldn't begin to picture him looking frightened. I wish you'd told me, she said quietly. You are an Ironwood, aren't you? Sophia mentioned other families, but...
I wish I could say I wasn't, he said, disgust curling his upper lip. I don't associate with them, not anymore. This is purely a matter of business to me. I don't travel, I don't obey Ironwood. I live my life free from all that. And when the transaction is complete, they'll be cut out of my life for as long as I can keep it.
What was she missing here, then? If he hated the Ironwood so much he was practically spitting as he talked about them, why agree to work for them? And if he could travel anywhere, to any time, why stay in one so openly hostile to him? Based on what Jack had told her, Nicholas and Chase had been raised by Hall from the time they were boys, and Nicholas said he'd been sailing from that age. So when had he done his traveling?
I don't travel. I don't obey Ironwood. I live my life free from all that.
And why had he stopped? Etta could feel him pulling back, retreating not only into his mind, but instinctively stepping back in the direction of the captain's cabin.
Knowing what they're like, you still won't bring me back home, she asked.
Do you know where the passage is that Sophia brought me through? Is it in Nassau?
The ship sailed out of Nassau, so it's a likely conclusion to draw, but...
He shook his head.
I was never given a list of the passages and their locations. What year are you from, precisely?
She told him, and it was worth it alone for the expression of complete wonder that transformed his face.
I was told there wasn't a passage that opened beyond the Second World War. That is the commonly held belief. Of course, I do know there are many ancient passages that are uncharted, their destinations unknown. Perhaps yours is one of them. What family do you belong to?
Lyndon, she said. According to Sophia.
She'd caught him by surprise again.
Lyndon, are you certain?
She could be lying, I guess, but she did mention my mom, Rose.
Etta stole a glance at his face.
Do you recognize the name?
He blew out a long breath from his nose, unable to look at her face.
Who in our small world hasn't heard of Rose Lyndon? She's the only traveler to successfully outwit Ironwood. She stole something of his and disappeared without a trace.
My God.
What are you then?
Ransom.
Why wouldn't he have just taken her if he found the two of you? Is she still alive?
Etta nodded, latching onto this small piece of information.
What else do you know about her?
Anything?
Only that she left a broken heart in her wake. Augustus Ironwood, Cyrus's son and heir, spent years searching for her. Went nearly mad with it.
Nicholas shook his head, and when he spoke again there was a blaze of promise in his words.
I'll ensure that you get back to your time. If you are bait, or if he intends to use you to threaten Rose, Then we'll leave at our first opportunity and search for the passage ourselves.
Disappointment sliced through her. If. She hated that word now. If and only if she was in true danger, he'd help her. Of course he wasn't going to turn around out of pity. In the first place, he didn't know where to bring her. In the second, he was earning good money for this job. But, as stupid and small as it made her feel, she had hoped. She'd read something in his hesitation. Her stomach gave a firm, desperate little twist.
"You said someone was killed," he began. "Who was it?"
The first words that floated to her lips were a lie. She hated herself for it, for wanting to give in to the easy simplicity of a fake story, rather than peel off the bandage and bleed every messy feeling and thought about the violin all over again. But she liked this honesty between them. It felt like something real and solid, strong enough to tie herself to, when there were so many lies and secrets trying to pull her in every direction at once.
"You've been through a trial," he said quietly when she'd finished explaining. "I'm sorry for it. I was about to ask if you'd like me to find the violin that Mr. Goody mentioned, if it might be a comfort to you."
She felt sick at the thought, shaking her head. "The opposite. I can't. I can barely stand the thought of playing right now, not until I get her back." He opened his mouth to say something, then promptly shut it, shaking his head.
"What?"
Ada asked.
"You mean to save your instructor, Alice?" he asked. "Change the past."
"I know how it looks, but she was innocent. She didn't deserve to die, and not because of me."
He let out a heavy sigh, with a kind of pity that turned her stomach again.
Ada lifted her hand off the rail as the wind kicked up and the ship tipped down to the right. The soles of her shoes were too soft, too slippery, and she felt one foot slide out from under her. An arm banded around her waist, pulling her feet back to the deck and to the solid, warm anchor of Nicholas. Her face was pressed against his shoulder, her fingernails digging into, twisting the back of his jacket. All she could hear was her own breath grating against the silence. All she could feel was the jackhammer beat of a heart hidden beneath layers of fabric and warmth. Ada stepped back, trying to think of some way to break her awareness of the hand pressed firmly to the small of her back. He beat her to it.
"Careful," he breathed out, glancing down at the polished black leather of his shoes. "I've only the one pair left."
"Still at it?"
Ada couldn't say which of them was more startled at the sound of Chase's voice.
"The next watch starts soon. Better get the lady back to her cabin."
He stood a short distance away from them at the edge of the hatch, arms crossed over his chest. It was too dark to make out his expression, but he didn't move until Nicholas took a generous step away from her, his hands suddenly clasped together in a knot behind his back.
"Time to retire, Miss Spencer," said Nicholas.
"I'll escort you to your cabin."
He didn't take her arm or offer a hand. Nicholas kept a careful distance after that, his hand still hidden behind his back. Now she understood how the Ardent's crew had felt as they were led down into the belly of the ship, unsure of when, or even if, they'd be allowed to take in the sun, the stars, the sky. She hadn't appreciated the conversation for the small slice of freedom it was. Between Sophia and the crew, would the two of them ever be able to speak openly again before they reached New York? His thoughts mirrored hers, apparently.
10 days to Long Island, said Nicholas.
Perhaps fewer if the wind is in our favor. I'm glad we had the chance to speak now, as I doubt Miss Ironwood will let you out of her sight once her stomach settles.
Ada paused by her door, and he paused at the captain's cabin, just across the way. "Can I ask you one thing?" Ada whispered. He nodded, his eyes shining with the light from a nearby lantern. She took in a deep breath, inhaling the scent of salt and wax, and considered her words. "If you can travel anywhere, to any time, for the most part," she began. "Why do you stay here, in an era where there are men like Wren, who treat you that way?"
"You presume I have a choice," he said. "Good night, Miss Spencer. Rest well."
With that, he disappeared into his cabin, shutting the door firmly behind him. 7. Somewhere at the end of a long line of hazy gray days, Nicholas woke at the first touch of shell-pink morning light, the devil's own hammers at work inside his skull. Bloody rum. Bloody dead captain hiding the bloody bottle in a place Nicholas could bloody well find in a moment he needed to numb his nerves. Good ideas had in the dark, he thought with a groan, were generally best left there. The call of sighted land was repeated as he rubbed his face, his legs were the last part of him to realize that sleep was over, prickling painfully as he shifted. He swore as his knees connected with solid wood, his berth. He slid along the berth's padding until he was sitting with his back against solid wood, his legs mostly stretched out in front of him. Above him, the ship's replacement bell sounded, signaling the morning watch. Nicholas swallowed to ease the dryness of his mouth, and stared up at the low ceiling overhead, listening to the footsteps and calls above him on the deck. Land meant their 10-day voyage back to the colonies was over. In a matter of hours, he would come face to face with the man who'd attempted to destroy him. He unfolded his legs, stretching, and clenched his teeth against the cold air swirling around him. He dressed quickly and had nearly finished shaving when Jack brought in his coffee and porridge. Chase appeared just as the boy was on his way out, filling the doorway with his broad shoulders and a storm cloud of anxiety.
"It's an hour to Oyster Bay," he said, shutting the door behind him. "Tell me once and for all that you're certain about this madness."
Rather than risk bringing the young ladies into New York Harbor on a captured British merchantman, Nicholas had made preparations with Ironwood to bring them ashore near Oyster Bay, off the Long Island Sound, where they would be met by a carriage. Nicholas remembered enough of this conflict's future to know that, by this day, the 21st of September, the British would already be in control of the city and its harbor. Wren had been right about this. If caught with a captured British ship, he and his prize crew would be tried as pirates, and, worse yet, traitors.
"I'm certain," Nicholas said, straightening his jacket. "Do you foresee any problems bringing the Ardent into New London without me?" "I think we'll manage the feat, but however will I keep a dry eye knowing you're gone," Chase said dryly.
It had been his sole condition that the Ardent, its captured cargo and his crew, be kept well out of the way of trouble and brought directly to the Lows in Connecticut. Cyrus Ironwood, however, had demanded that Nicholas escort the girls into Manhattan, where he had taken up temporary residence. He had refused to meet them out on Long Island, or even in Connecticut, where they might have avoided the British altogether. As always, the sun rose and set on Ironwood's expectations, and any complications in bringing Sophia and Etta to him would be up to Nicholas to solve. They had less than a day now to meet Cyrus Ironwood's firm arrival deadline. There simply wasn't time for complications, not with so much pay at stake.
"Will you see to it that our two passengers are ready to depart?" Nicholas asked. "I'd like to make one last inspection of the ship and crew." "Miss Etta Spencer has been up for nearly 2 hours," Chase said with a chuckle. "Said she sensed we were close and was too eager to sleep. Sensed it. Personally, I think she saw one last opportunity for some freedom from her sister."
As Nicholas suspected, Sophia had taken a turn for the better and was alert enough to terrorize her sister with her constant, domineering presence for the rest of the voyage. Nicholas had given up counting the number of times he had come across Etta, hiding somewhere in the galley or forecastle, playing a game of cards with Jack and the other boys, only to have Sophia swoop down in a swirl of silk and linen and snatch her away. In all of 10 days, he'd managed to steal only 4 words. It left his stomach sour and his mind ill at ease. He glanced back at the table, and at the violin and bow resting atop the pile of charts. He'd found it the night after the fateful dinner, stowed inside a cabinet, and had left it out in the hope, on the off chance she might change her mind and seek it out. Chase cleared his throat.
"Before you make for shore, if I may be so bold, my dear friend." "You may not, but you will," Nicholas replied. "I know you've struggled to find a moment alone, and perhaps I should not have interrupted that first night, but I should hope it's as obvious to you that the girl has paid special mind to you." "She's a charming creature, and she's interested in the business of sailing," Nicholas said quickly. "She has paid special mind to everyone present, yourself included." "I'm not finished," Chase cut him off. "I was not implying anything improper. I wanted to ask if he remembered Hall's wife, Anne, what he said of her.
I only remember what happened when she passed, he lied.
A long year in which they had chased Hall from tavern to tavern and hadn't spent a single day on a ship. He'd had no idea a man so large and powerful, who'd fought and survived 1,000 battles, could be broken into so many pieces when his lady took ill.
Liar,
Chase said, not unkindly.
He said he'd never remarry because he'd never find another lady that fit so neatly at his side. He called her his equal in spirit.
Nicholas's hands smoothed over his sleeves, trying to formulate his argument. Anne had been one of the sweetest ladies the world was ever likely to see. She'd cared for both of the boys as if they were her own, and had never questioned the way Hall had brought them home, one at a time, like the strays they were. She was the pearl to the captain's rough, wild reef. He couldn't let his friend finish, put the hopeful thought into the world. It would grow into something that would only crush him in the end.
She's not for me.
I think she is,
Chase insisted.
Yet you can't see it.
What I see is that there's no future there, even if the lady were amenable.
The words were sour in his mouth.
What do you expect, for me to marry her? The match is forbidden by law.
You've never let expectations rule your life before. Why start with something as important as this?
Nicholas didn't want to puzzle it out and arrive at the conclusion he'd feared all along. It was better to stand aside from it, not to invest any more precious thought in the matter. Besides, it assumed too much, like the feelings of the lady in question.
Fine, Chase said gruffly. I'll tell the others that you've laid no claim.
Nicholas's eyes narrowed.
What the devil do you mean? Half the men worship at our feet. The other half have already proposed marriage, including young Jack, who has sworn to his dear miss that he'll be true if she'll only wait a few more years for him. Unrepentant rascal.
A rumbling irritation rolled through him as he reached down, running a finger along the violin's curved body.
Have they been untoward?
Not in the least, Chase laughed. They like her fine, though. Enough to want her to stay.
And for that reason alone, Nicholas was grateful that this short voyage was at an end. His remaining time on the Ardent escaped him like wind passing through his fingers. Much sooner than he might have liked, Nicholas found himself surveying the emerald tufts of distant trees along the shoreline. They faded in and out of his sight with the slow rolling fog, giving him the uneasy sense that the pale, misty air was breathing around his shoulders. The scent of damp earth wove itself through the smell of the sea, settling heavy in his lungs. Etta wore a gown of deep blue, and the color reminded him of midnight, the winter seas, as if it had been meant specifically to draw his eye, to speak to the devil in him. He stood beside Chase on the deck, watching as the crew passed her around to say their farewells. It was near impossible to fight against the pull of her tide, but he forced himself to, turning to face his friend more fully.
"I'll meet you in port in a week's time," he said. "Make sure the agent is fully apprised of the fact that Wren is hostile. Likely won't cooperate in dealings with the prize court."
"Understood,"
Chase said, clasping his shoulder.
"Send word if you're delayed."
"I won't be," Nicholas said.
His friend's look told him Chase wasn't nearly as confident. The jolly boat, one of the ship's small rowboats, was lowered. Nicholas would have preferred the stability of a longboat, as well as the help of the additional hands required to man it. But this would suit him fine. It wasn't so long of a distance for him to row alone, and both had transferred their few possessions to bags he'd sewn from excess sail, rather than haul their trunks. Once Nicholas was situated, the girls began their careful descent into the jolly boat. Sophia looked ready to spit on him should he try to help, but he did reach up and grip Etta by the waist as she stepped down, bracing his legs against the pitch and bob of the boat. He felt where she held onto his shoulders long after he sat down and picked up the oars. Nicholas looked back up to wave a farewell to the crew, just as Chase leaned down and whispered something in Jack's ear. The boy brightened, whispered something back, and jumped up onto the rail.
"How about a kiss, eh?"
Jack shouted down. Etta laughed and obliged, blowing a kiss. With one last dry look up to a guffawing Chase, Nicholas drew the oars back and began the first long stroke, A good burn coursed through his stiff muscles as he eased into the steady motion. He kept his mouth shut as he rode, even as Sophia grumbled.
"Can't you go any faster?"
The mist began to burn away as the sun rose higher. Birds called from where they hovered above the water, and he didn't mind in the slightest when the sweat soaked through his shirt, not when there was fresh, cool air in his lungs. Sophia closed her eyes, drumming her fingers against the sack in her lap impatiently. Etta fixed on a point past Nicholas's shoulder. He craned his neck and followed her gaze toward the dark outline of the trees lining this deserted stretch of beach. Nicholas had read Cyrus Ironwood's description of the meeting spot to Flitch, and they'd worked to match it to the coastal charts and maps. But he didn't feel confident they'd done a good job until Etta said,
"I think I see a light."
Nicholas saw it now, too. A lantern cast a faint glow into the gloom that clung to the rocky beach, and as they grew closer, the dark form behind it took shape. Nicholas drew the oars in, letting the tide do the bulk of the work, until the bottom of the jolly boat struck sand. He jumped out, splashing into the cold water, and dragged the boat ashore. Before he could reach in to steady her, she stepped out, to warn her about the strange, hollow feeling that crawled up your legs as they settled themselves to the stillness of land. Sophia had jumped out and crumpled on the loose sand. It was manners, and the legacy of the saintly Anne Hall, that made Nicholas reach down and offer her a hand. The expression on Sophia's face, the flush of embarrassment, made her look like the young woman she was, not the wasp she insisted on being. For a moment he might have even detected what Julian had once found appealing. But then he saw her remember who he was, what he had done. Her face went as hard as flint, and her fingers curled in the sand as if she might throw a handful of it into his eyes. When she stood again, it was by her own strength. Etta placed a hand on his shoulder to steady herself as she stepped out of the belly of the boat. Together they watched Sophia stagger toward the waiting coach and driver. He ought to tell her that there were yet more rules about touching, about the propriety this century demanded. But perhaps not yet. "If you can believe it, that's actually an improvement in her mood," Etta whispered. "This morning she threw half her trunk at me when I came in to wake her up."
"Ah, the Ironwood charm," Nicholas said. "I suppose then she made you pick it all up for her as well."
"Actually, I threw the water from the basin on her to cool her off." A dark look passed over Etta's face as they watched the carriage rock with the force of Sophia's entry. "Should have grabbed the chamber pot instead." He barked out a sharp, surprised laugh.
"Thank you for showing that measure of restraint," he said,
still struggling with his smile.
"I wish I could say that you'll have a more welcome reception when you meet Cyrus Ironwood. But be warned. If he senses fear in you, he'll take particular delight in tearing you to pieces."
Etta set her shoulders back, staring ahead of him up the hill.
"Well, you'll have nothing to be afraid of," she told him,
a little smile on her face.
"Because I'll be with you."
Nicholas shut his eyes and took in one last breath of the sea-kissed air. If only that would be enough.
New York City, 1776. 8. The smoke rose to greet them miles before they reached the Brooklyn Ferry.
"What is that?" Etta asked Nicholas. "Some kind of battle?"
He seemed just as perplexed as she was, following her gaze out of the window to where black plumes were streaming into the darkening sky.
"That's your cue," Etta told Sophia. "Anytime you want to elaborate on what that terrifying thing in the distance is, that would be great." Sophia studied her fingernails.
"Withholding information endangers all of us," Nicholas reminded her. "I can't protect you if I don't know what's ahead."
She dropped her hands back into her lap with a look of exasperation.
"Fine. It's the fire. It's been burning since this morning. The Great Fire of New York. You would know that if you'd actually paid attention to any of your training."
"If I'd received any training aside from how not to be killed, how to avoid sharing our secret, and how Julian wanted his cravat tied, I might have been able to retain it," he fired back.
In the midst of the thunderous charge sparking between them, Etta blinked, trying to remember if she'd ever read or learned about this.
"What caught fire?" she asked.
To kick up that much smoke, it would have been enormous. The entire west side of the city, Sophia said, after another dragging silence. From what I remember, it broke out this morning, the 21st of September. It's probably burned through the quarter by now. Not for the first time, Etta thought about how strange it must be for the Ironwoods to live outside of the normal flow of time, to know everything that came before them, and nearly everything that would happen, up to a certain point, after. It must have made it much easier to invest their money, choose their homes, and pick their battles for the benefit of the family. What started it? It depends on who you ask. The British seem to think it was one of Washington's spies. That some mongrel said it when the army was forced to flee the city. Nearly everything seemed to be made of wood in this time period. All it would take was a single spark. Etta rubbed at her forehead, glancing at Nicholas. He'd untied his neckcloth and let it hang over his shoulders. His shirt parted at the front to reveal a span of warm skin. His clothes were well-worn, rumpled from days of work and travel, and he seemed unbothered by it even as Sophia fussed with her gown and beat the road dust from the skirt. She had patted on more perfume of some kind, but Etta focused on the scent of him. It was cool breezes and sunshine and rum. While Sophia's anxiety was manifesting in the way she kept folding and unfolding her hands in her lap, and in the impatient jumping of her legs under her skirt, Nicholas seemed to be retreating inside himself. The worry she'd seen on his face when they'd come ashore felt very different from this. There had been some anger knotted into his exasperation for Ironwood when he'd warned her. His finger was currently worrying his upper lip. His gaze was cast out over the landscape rolling by, but he didn't seem to be focusing on any one thing. Etta thought that Nicholas could likely count the things that unnerved him on one hand, maybe even one finger. He could manage Sophia, and he seemed prepared for Ironwood. So then what was left to put such ice in his expression? Rather than sit in the unbearable silence of not knowing, she asked, "Did you get to see New York before the fire?" Idiot question. She knew he'd been to New York, that he'd even lived there for a time. Jack had told her as much during her fact-finding mission. It was amazing how small you could feel when someone wouldn't so much as look at you. For a second, Etta was sure he wasn't going to answer at all, just keep his gaze fixed out of the window. Then she got a single word. Once. What did you think of it? Etta pressed, focusing on her irritation so she wouldn't have to acknowledge the creeping feeling of being heard. Filthy. To her surprise, Sophia said, "The only point on which we agree. They throw the slop and garbage out into the streets, hoping the animals and vermin will eat it, and whatever's left washes out into the rivers with the rain. You can smell the city for miles before it comes into view. Fire smoke will only improve it." Here was the truth about the past, as Etta was coming to realize. It was startlingly quiet at times. The pace of life moved slower than a crawl, and the smell of the people and places was actually unbelievable. Her nose still hadn't adjusted to it. By the time they rolled to a stop, and the carriage rocked as the driver stepped off his perch to open their door, Etta would have tried splitting her skull open against the ground to relieve the pressure of her headache. Sophia stumbled out on unsteady legs behind her, using her shoulders for support. Nicholas brought up the rear, handing over a small bag of what looked like money to the driver, who went to tend to his horses. Smoke clogged the air, a steady breeze carrying it across the bobbing water of the East River. Etta could taste it now at the back of her throat. Buried beneath the overpowering smell of charred wood was a rotting sweetness and hot manure. But Etta wasn't sure if it was coming from the burning garbage or the smell of the soldiers moving around her. The first time she'd seen the pops of vivid scarlet scattered across the rolling green landscape of Long Island, she was shocked. She recognized the famous redcoats at once, the uniforms the British soldiers wore as they made their way through the towns, patrolled the roads, stopped and read the papers the driver handed them at each checkpoint. Up close, Etta could see the careful white and gold detailing on the lapels, the shine of the buttons running down the cream-colored vests they wore underneath. Most of their breeches and stockings were splattered with dust from the road, and each wore a different version of the same exhaustion as they milled around the ferry landing, ushering crowds to and from the flat barges, away from the burning New York City.
"Would burn it to the ground before they let us have it, would they? Deliberate,"
The fire's taken it all from Broadway to the Hudson, going north and west and taking the only decent taverns with it.
Etta turned as two soldiers strode around her, heads bent closely together. Seeing her, they both nodded politely and went on their way with nothing more than, "Evening, ma'am." The faces beneath the black hats were surprisingly young. Why was she always assuming everyone in the past was so much older than she was? In the whole course of history, war had always fallen on the shoulders of the young. After some negotiation, the ferryman agreed to make one last trip over the river before night fell, and he was due home. Sophia charged forward like a gunshot, practically pushing her way onto the low, flat boat. A hand appeared in the corner of Etta's eye, Nicholas, offering to help her step down. After his earlier aloofness, Etta didn't feel much like validating his chivalry, so instead fixed her gaze on the forest of masts and sails drifting along the river. The non-existent skyline of this Manhattan made it impossible to figure out exactly where they were. Somehow, not even being able to orient herself in the city she'd grown up in made something twist sharply deep inside her. The distance from the very tip of the island, what she knew was Battery Park, the view of it. She closed her eyes, picturing Brooklyn Bridge stretching over her head, the fanned-out cables, the sturdy stone arches. But when she opened her eyes again, there were no glossy windowed skyscrapers scratching at the violet evening sky. The smoke wasn't drifting around the faces of luxury high-rise apartments. None of the buildings seemed taller than a few stories. Two ferrymen moved them along the river using what looked like long oars, splashing and thudding, nothing like the mechanical roar of the modern ferry's motor engines. It was so quiet without the highways, the traffic. Etta looked up, waiting to see a plane cross the sky overhead. "This isn't New York," she thought. "This isn't my home. This can't be it." "Do not cry," she ordered herself. "Don't you dare." It wouldn't do anything except draw more unwanted attention to the fact that she was out of place. Nicholas stood nearby, leaning against the ferry in his usual pose, arms crossed over his chest, face devoid of almost any emotion. She didn't understand how one person could guard their thoughts and feelings as fiercely as he did.
"Are you talking to me again?" she asked.
"I was born here, in 1757.
His eyes shut briefly, but Etta saw something move in them.
"Initially, it wasn't pleasant."
Etta waited for him to continue. Nicholas swallowed hard.
"Captain Hall, whom you met briefly, he and his wife had a little house near the Commons. After he purchased my freedom, I went to live with them, and my life was vastly improved."
"Purchased my freedom." The pain lanced through her, hot and jagged, chased by confusion.
"You mean," Etta began,
"you were born into the Ironwoods, but they..."
Anger choked the rest of the words from her throat.
Nicholas shrugged. He shrugged.
"I wasn't legitimate, nor was I wanted. A child takes on the status of its mother in this time period. My mother was their property. Therefore, so was I."
Nicholas glanced at her.
"They didn't know that I'd inherited their gift until later, after I'd already lived for a time with Hall and his wife."
"You grew up with Chase too, right?" she asked. Seeing a flicker of surprise, she added, "He told me a little about it a few days ago, while we were walking on the deck. That Mrs. Hall told the captain he wasn't allowed to take either of you out to sea until she taught you to read and write." At that, he actually smiled.
"She was a lady of uncommon kindness and bold spirit. Once we lost her, there was no reason to come back here, aside from occasional business."
"How did Hall find you?" Etta asked. "Why did the Ironwoods..." She couldn't bring herself to say "sell you" without wanting to vomit. Nicholas lowered his voice.
"You know, I presume, that the ability has become rarer as the family has moved forward, yes?"
Etta nodded.
"Hall is a more distant relation to the Ironwoods. In fact, he was taken into the Ironwoods when Ironwood finished off his family, the Hemlocks, and brought the survivors into line," Nicholas explained. "But he isn't as you and I are. He's what we call a guardian. They cannot travel. They are stationary in their natural times, but they watch the entrances to the passages to ensure the safety of the travelers, and take note of all comings and goings. They also do other work for the family, see to their financial interests and property in various eras, relay messages between the centuries.
Etta's eyes widened. How in the world do they do that?
If they precede us, they leave letters in various family vaults which are checked by other guardians. If they follow this era, the letters are brought back by a designated traveler. Hall himself was required to oversee the transportation and sale of sugar from one of their plantations in the Caribbean from 1750 until just recently.
She was missing a piece of this. Had you met Hall before you went to live with him?
He shook his head. Ironwood decided to have the old family house on Queen Street sold, along with its possessions. My mother was purchased outright with another house slave, and claimed I ran away. She left me hiding in a cupboard, and hoped I'd be able to escape and live a life of freedom. I would never have agreed if I'd known what was truly happening.
Etta was about to ask what had become of his mother, but he barreled on quickly.
Hall found me when they came to inspect the house before the purchasers arrived. I was half dead from hunger, filthy as a stray pup. My mother had told me to stay put and keep silent, and I was much better at following orders then.
Nicholas gave her a wry smile.
He carried me out, made sure my freedom was legal. It was years before Ironwood came back to that era and learned of me. I trained and traveled for a time on Ironwood's behalf, but no more. I'll not leave the sea or my true family again.
Etta forced herself to move past the thought of him as a young boy, hiding in the dark for days. What will you do after you finish your business with Ironwood? He shifted, absently reaching out to rub at his shoulder.
I need to meet Chase and the others to see to my responsibilities as prize master. Captain Hall will be back in port before the month's end, and will sail again soon after.
Of course he had responsibilities. That was his life. It had just so happened to overlap with hers for a few days. Why did Etta feel so anxious at the thought of him walking away? "Is it safe to travel? Will you be all right?" she asked.
"Don't worry about me, Miss Spencer," he said as they bumped up against the other ferry building. "I always manage."
"You could call me Etta," she said, smiling. "I like that." There was a crack in that calm mask, a flash. Etta's eyes read it as anger, but instinct registered something worse, a painful kind of shock, as if she'd knocked him off the ferry and into the cold river.
"You," he began, his gaze shifting up to the sky, a small, pained smile on his face. Etta couldn't look away, not at Sophia, who was calling her name, not at the sails cutting through the blooming dark.
He let out a quiet laugh, sounding almost dismayed, his hands pressed hard against his sides.
"There are times, Miss Spencer, you defeat me utterly."
Before she could process those words, he'd moved to the front of the ferry to assist the other men in securing it, and when it came time to disembark, only Sophia was waiting for her.
"Was he bothering you? Thank God he'll be gone soon enough," she said, loud enough for all the city to hear.
"No," Etta said quickly.
"Not at all."
Still, Sophia eyed Nicholas as he strode in front of them, blowing past a cluster of women with bright eyes and rouged cheeks. They were nearly spilling out of their low-cut dresses.
"Looking for a place to sleep, love?" one asked, trailing after him. "Hope the fire didn't get your pretty house. I've got a spot that's warm."
"I'm spoken for," he said, gently removing her hand from his shoulder. "Have a nice night, ladies."
"Spoken for?" Etta watched his back, the stretch and bunch of the muscles he moved. Sophia then let out a strangled gasp and swore a blue streak as she stepped directly into a pile of fresh horse droppings. Etta's stomach actually cringed at the way the smell tangled with the smoke.
"Of all the rotten luck!"
It was nearly pitch black by the time Nicholas found Inwood's carriage in the chaos of the fire refugees. They were staying, in Sophia's words, at a mean little tavern called the Dove, outside of the city proper, outside what Etta knew in her time was the financial district. Cyrus Ironwood had thrown enough money around to convince the proprietor to let his family's rooms in the attic for 3 nights,
while they and their servants slept in the cellar. "Why not just buy a real house in the city?" Etta said, thinking of Nicholas's story. Clearly the family could afford it.
"Grandfather is making inquiries about available property," Sophia explained, her voice strained. "He's decided to subject us to this era for the foreseeable future, so he'll need more permanent accommodations. For now, he requires us at the Dove, so that is where we'll go."
"Not looking forward to all that rustic living?" Etta asked, arching a brow. Their path ran along what the driver had called the Old Post Road. Etta had recognized the names of streets when they were in the thick of this version of Manhattan, Wall Street, Broadway. But once they were past the Commons, a green park crowded with fire refugees, their rescued possessions, and all the soldiers trying to keep them in line, the city turned to farmland. Empty, rolling farmland. Etta shook her head in amazement.
"I know," Sophia murmured dreamily. "It tempts one to buy up a few parcels and hold on to them for a few centuries."
In the city, her city, she got used to moving in the shadows of giant buildings during the day and sacrificing your view of the stars to light pollution. But out here, the sky was naked, untouched, revealing all of its thousands of glittering lights. There was nothing to see beyond occasional houses, some small, some grand. Etta heard the bleating of sheep and whinnying of horses, the quiet bubbling of what sounded like streams. She missed the rapid pulse of life at home, the way the heat rose off the cement, the sunlight's reflection in endless glass windows, the crowds, the constant drone of traffic, alarms, trains. "This will all be over soon," she reminded herself. "Hopefully." The tension that wrapped around her stomach spread through her veins like spider webs, too sticky to dislodge completely. Etta tried to picture what this grandfather would look like, what he would think of her, but she'd only had Sophia's and Nicholas's descriptions to go on. Together they had painted a rather vivid image in her mind of a man with a bloody sword, guided by a shriveled lump of ash and ice for a heart, in possession of actual fangs and claws. "Breathe," she thought a bit desperately. "Breathe." What else could she do? Whatever information she might squeeze out of him would only help her to get away, to figure out how to get back to Alice. The Dove Tavern was farther uptown than she'd expected. She spent most of the ride trying to use the position of the East River to figure out where they were on the island. Toward the east, but still close to the center. Maybe what she knew as Lexington or Third Avenue. "What is that?" she asked, leaning forward to get a better look at the constellation of small campfires on the ground up ahead. Nicholas leaned closer to see, his warm arm pressing against hers.
"The Royal Artillery Park, if I had to guess."
The guess was a good one. As they drew closer, the torches and lanterns in the camp blazed. The evidence of war gleamed. Beyond the impressive row of cannons were lines of wagons, carts, stables, white tents. What plain buildings Etta saw were flanked by the few trees that hadn't been hacked to pieces for firewood and stacked nearby. The Dove stood directly across from the park, hugging the dirt road. The candles in its windows warmed its plain wooden face, and it looked more like a large colonial house to Etta's eyes than a tavern. A two-story house, in fact, not including the attic, and one that seemed to lean ever so slightly to the right. Someone had tried to add a bit of charm with red paint on the shutters. A wooden sign hung over the street, swaying as Sophia passed it. In the dark, the soaring bird carved into it looked more like a crow than a dove.
"Come along," Sophia said, after the driver had lifted her down from the carriage.
Etta trailed behind her, trapped between the thorns of anticipation and trepidation. No matter which way her heart swung, she felt stung by the intensity of the feeling. Her own lingering excitement at being brought into the fold of this secret history sickened her, twisting her inside so much more than the dread of what Ironwood really wanted from her. This is it. She could go home. This is it. Find a way to save Alice. This is it. Etta just needed to breathe. Nicholas stepped up beside her, gazing up at the tavern's windows. It was dark, but the light from the lanterns reflected warmly against his skin. Etta looked away quickly. She knew he could read her anxious expression as easily as she had read his, and she couldn't stand the thought of him seeing her weak and out of her depth again.
"The only way out is through," he said.
Etta nodded, squaring her shoulders. The noise from the tavern burst out onto the road like a tangled cord as a patron, a soldier who'd only managed to get one arm through his uniform coat, staggered out. He patted at his wig, swinging around unsteadily to stare first at Sophia, then Etta.
"Hello, girls," he began softly.
Etta stepped back, bumping into a solid warmth. Nicholas's hand closed lightly around her elbows, and she was lifted that last step out past the soldier, to the door.
"Good night, sir," Nicholas said firmly.
When he opened the door, he released the muggy air trapped inside.
"Don't look at them," he said.
Etta barely heard him over the roar of conversation. It was minutes past midnight, but there were more than enough soldiers and common men circling the tables, hauling themselves up out of their seats to stagger toward the bar. She sucked in a deep breath. The air was flavored with wax from the dripping candles, sour body odor, and the hoppy tinge of ale. The skirt of her dress caught on something, yanking Etta hard enough to stumble into Nicholas again. She reached down to unhook it, and jumped when her hand brushed warm, damp flesh. Nicholas let out a sharp breath and reached down to push away the meaty hand. The soldier seemed to be sweating out every ounce of alcohol that went into him. His shirt was drenched at the pits and all along his back.
"Keep going," Nicholas murmured.
Etta tried to turn back, to cut the man with a glare, but Nicholas guided her toward the stairs at the back of the room.
"I could have handled that," Etta muttered. "I know," he said, his breath on her skin. "I did him an undeserved favor. But if you demand blood, I'll give him a scar to remember on my way out."
The words rocketed through her. Etta turned so quickly on the bottom step, and the bulk of her gown threw her so off balance that he had to reach up to steady her. The weight and warmth of his hands bled through the gown, the stays, the shift, but she hardly noticed. They were finally standing eye to eye. He quirked a brow in response.
"You're leaving tonight?" Etta asked.
"For Connecticut? No, not until the morning. But I'll need to find an inn."
"You can't stay here."
His expression softened, and Etta could have sworn, just for an instant, his grip on her tightened.
"No, Miss Spencer, I cannot."
"Come on, Etta," Sophia called. "He doesn't like to be kept waiting."
Etta didn't budge. Softly, Nicholas asked,
"Do you really believe I'd take my leave of you without so much as a goodbye? If nothing else, I gave you my word that I would take you away from here if you were in danger."
"Promise?" Etta whispered.
"Always."
The stairs creaked under their combined weight, and were so narrow that Etta was tempted to turn to the side and walk up that way. Nicholas had to bend at the waist to avoid bashing his head against the low-hanging ceiling. Etta glanced at the second floor as they passed it, trying to spy through the cracks in the doors that had been left partially open. They must have been private rooms. There were fewer men up here, with their uniforms in better shape than the ones she'd seen below. Based on Sophia's description, she'd been expecting the walls to be falling down around their ears, the furniture and rugs to be moving around the halls on the backs of a sea of rodents. Instead, it seemed tidy, if cramped and a little bleak. It was even plainer on the third level. There were three doors to choose from. Sophia smoothed her hair, then her dress, and moved to the one on the far left, where a man armed with a rifle was standing guard. Nicholas measured him with a single look. Before Sophia could knock, a ringing voice called,
"Enter!"
Etta, Sophia, and Nicholas followed the voice. This room was as bare as the hall, but practically stifling with the heat from the fireplace. With the exception of a four-poster bed with a side table, a trunk, and a porcelain chamber pot, the only other occupant was a wing-back chair. A man was in it, positioned directly in front of a roaring fire. He didn't stand as they came in, merely absorbed each of them with a single look. Etta heard Sophia swallow hard. The old man raised his right hand expectantly, and she practically tripped in her rush to step forward and kiss the gold ring on it.
"Hello, Grandfather. You look well."
"And you smell like a horse's arse."
Etta let out a shocked laugh, and his sharp gaze swung toward her, choking the sound off with a single tilt of his head. His face was round like Sophia's, his features bold despite the drag of age. His hooded eyelids hung over icy blue eyes. The corners of his mouth were naturally tipped down, giving him a look of tired apathy, like he could hardly abide their presence. He adjusted the blue silk damask robe he'd tossed over his shirt and breeches. That single look ripped Etta open faster than any razor. He turned to Sophia.
"You're dismissed."
She jumped as if he'd shoved her in the direction of the door.
"But..."
"You question me?"
he asked calmly. Sophia sealed her lips and turned to look at Nicholas.
"He stays,"
the old man said firmly, with an impatient wave.
"My God, child, I'll die of old age before you even reach the door."
Etta saw the way Sophia took in a deep breath, set her shoulders back, and moved with practiced grace on her way out. And she understood something about the other girl, truly understood it for the first time. Sophia wanted in when she was only ever being sent out.
"Step fully into the light," the old man ordered when the door was shut.
He set the book in his lap on the floor. Nicholas stood with his hands clasped behind his back, fingers curled into fists. When she stepped forward, so did he, remaining a small step in front of her.
"I'm Etta,"
she said, trying to fill the agonizing silence that followed. The longer she went without any sort of response, the more she had to fight the way her feet naturally wanted to turn toward the door. In all of her experiences of stage fright, each crippling attack of performance anxiety, she'd never felt so smothered by pure dread. With the heat of the fire at her back, and hours of travel behind her, she felt a pressure start to build just beneath her lungs. Why was she just standing here? Why wasn't she yelling, telling him what she really thought of the way he'd forced her to come here without any explanation? She could have been home, but here she was, because he wanted her, and he wasn't doing a damn thing other than a passable impression of a gargoyle. And this was the same man who had kept both Nicholas and his mother enslaved, who thought it was fine to sacrifice their freedom in the name of playing a role and blending in.
"You're late, Samuel."
Maybe it was only a trick of the light, but Etta could have sworn Nicholas stiffened.
"My name is Nicholas now, as you've known for years, and I don't see how you've reached that conclusion. I wanted them here by the 21st, and yet here we are, 10 past the first hour of the 22nd. Your pay will be docked accordingly."
Etta's blood steamed.
"That's..."
"My man of business is downstairs. I expect you remember him. Of course he'll know you by your true name. Nicholas. My word. Perhaps you should have chosen the name Charlemagne when you decided to remake yourself. You certainly strode in here like an emperor."
Was the old man mocking Nicholas for choosing a name that he liked and wanted, rather than one given to him? What a vicious way to remind him of what he had been. "I can handle this." She clung to her mom's voice, the words, that trace of belief. If nothing else, she wouldn't flinch under the old man's steely gaze. She would make her mom proud.
"Tell me why I'm here," she said coldly. "Why do you think you're here?"
he asked, cocking one thin silver brow. A lion staring down a common house cat.
"I think your plan is to hold me hostage," she said. "To get back at my mom."
Cyrus let out a deep laugh.
"Do you? How would you feel if it was quite the opposite?"
Etta's gaze shot back toward him, disbelief twining with terror as the old man retrieved a small, glossy photograph from the front pocket of his silk robe. Her dread was so paralyzing, she almost couldn't lift an arm to take it from him. Her mother's face, partially obscured by a gag, glared back at her. If she'd looked frightened rather than furious, some part of Etta might have been able to believe it was someone else they'd found to impersonate her. But no. Rose was still wearing the dress she'd worn at the Met. The room around her was dark, but Etta recognized their living room all the same. An arm reached into the photo with a copy of the New York Times, dated the day after the concert. All she could see was Alice's face as her eyes slid shut that last time. All she could feel was Alice's blood as it dried on her hands.
Because of her, you owe this family, our kind, a debt,
the old man said.
And you will do exactly as I say, or she will take her last breath and